All right, welcome to the Resistance Roundtable, coming to you on WPKN the second Saturday of each month, where we engage in idle chit-chat on the total unraveling of our democracy and the fast approaching end of life on our planet. And we hope that you will join us for some chit-chat by calling 203-336-9756 to participate in this conversation. Generally, in the course of a show, an hour that seems to fly by, we try to pick on some of the issues that are on the screen that have coming down like shrapnel aimed at the body politic, so to speak. And there are so many that we, of course, can really just sort of randomly pick a few, and we'll do that again today. We do have a special feature, though. Today we're going to be focusing on the issue of free speech, freedom of speech, the First Amendment, and its connections to all the other issues, all the fight back, all the ways that people are trying to resist the right-wing assault on a fair and just society. And the freedom of speech and the First Amendment are, I think, sort of, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, co-host today, is, I think, very correct in framing this conversation around the First Amendment, because it seems to be the foundation for all the action that people are taking around these issues. And of course, it is under assault. So, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, welcome to the Resistance Roundtable. My name, by the way, is Richard Hill. Ruth Ann, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Richard. This is exciting today.
Yeah, should be good. And Scott Harris, who is a regular panelist on the show also, is away this week, will not be with us, sadly. So it's a one-on-one, Richard and Ruth Ann, but we hope that you will join in the conversation. Whenever the spirit moves you, call 203-336-9756 and pick an issue that you're concerned about, something that you've been thinking about, something that's been in the news, something that has been ignored by the corporate media, a local, a regional, or a national issue that you'd like to focus on that may or may not relate to our main topic today, which is the First Amendment, freedom of speech. It's under attack, but it's also our tool for fighting back. Ruth Ann, why don't you tell us about the special interview that we'll have today, just about 10:15, which will focus in on this issue in a very specific way.
There are a few blogs I follow religiously, and one of them is a blog sponsored by the American Association of University Professors. The blog is a spinoff of its magazine, Academe. And one of the most exciting people who blog on that site is Professor Henry Reichman, who teaches history at California State University at East Bay. He is the chair of AAUP's Committee A, and I'll probably talk about this right before he speaks as well, but that makes him pretty much an authority on the concept of academic freedom. And he will, and that's what he blogs about primarily, and he'll be talking about that today, specifically academic freedom and how it relates to the freedom of speech and how it is exercised ideally and why it's under threat on campuses. Everybody is reading about various kinds of campus unrest, and there's a lot of press coverage given to student protests against invited speakers. And Hank has written about that. And I see him every year at the annual meeting of the AAUP. And this year when I saw him, I said, we have to get you on the radio. So I'm excited that he's going to be here.
That is great. And of course, this issue has been very much in focus in the past 6 months, really. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about people objecting to speakers on campus, or, the curtailment of the rights of students and professors to speak on certain issues. So this will definitely be an interesting topic. Once again, the phone number here, if you'd like to participate in our conversation, and feel free to interrupt us at any time, because we are literally vamping here. We're improvising. There's so many issues to talk about, and the ones that you all are thinking about are just as relevant. 203-336-9756. My name is Richard Hill, here with Ruth Ann Baumgartner for the Resistance Roundtable. And so, Ruth Ann, as I said, that we could take a kind of a random approach here because there's so much to talk about, but what's the first issue on top of your list in terms of things that we should be concerned about?
I was shocked and amused at the same time, and I'm sure a lot of people were, to learn that when NPR did its annual reading of the Declaration of Independence on the 4th of July, they had angry calls and angry emails accusing them of partisanship, of un-Americanism, and of pushing a political agenda against the good of the United States. I don't know how many of these calls that they got were professional trolls, and we always have to watch for that, thanks to social media, and how many of them were victims of, now, I really did make this word up, patrianoia. I think it's a good one, and you're free to use it. Victims of patrianoia who are terrified, that who've been persuaded that the nation is under attack from within as well as from without, and they have to enforce some sort of political agenda in order to save the country. One thing that a lot of these people seem to be doing that upsets me very much is the equation of Christianity with Americanism, and a very fundamentalist and selective version of Christianity as well. It seems to me to be centered in Leviticus rather than the New Testament. I think Betsy DeVos's pushing of school vouchers and other forms of public financing of privatized education is partly driven by this Christian agenda, and that includes not only having the public money funneled to various kinds of religious schools, but also the support of homeschooling. And I don't want to badmouth that concept, because I have friends who homeschool for perfectly fine reasons, but I'm afraid that for every family that decides to homeschool so that their children can have an enriched education, there are a lot more who decide to homeschool so that their children's exposure to certain things can be reduced, exposure to different religions, exposure to different political orientations, exposure to different versions of the truth, including evolution, and exposure to people that they consider not really American or not really suitable for their children. I'm a product of public education. I adored going to school, and I came out of my public education not only with a really solid foundation, but also with what education is supposed to provide you, a liberalized view. And by that, I don't mean a politically liberal, but that widened and inviting view of what it was to be a person in this particular community. So I'm really upset about those attempts to limit what happens in education. This is also assessment-based testing and assessment-based education, all the things that cheapen an education and mechanize an education rather than making it the experience that will build a future for this nation. So that's my issue, the determined ignorance of certain forces and the dangers that poses to education and to the future of the country.
You know, it's particularly disturbing when that kind of energy, that kind of direction is coming from the very highest levels of the administration, you know. And I mean, it's disquieting when you see this sort of stuff, you know, this kind of like pushback against the Declaration of Independence, people thinking that that NPR is reading a revolutionary screed or something, trying to get people to rush to the barricades and start shooting.
It's also kind of amusing that when they heard an accusation about the tyrant and overthrowing the tyrant, they immediately saw it as an attack on Mr. Trump.
Yeah, tyrant has become a very acceptable word in some quarters. But yes, so when the Department of Education itself starts to advocate for the type of thing that you're talking about, that's when the hackles really have to go up. So that's an interesting first topic here. You know, we've been talking a lot about attacks on the press, and there are a few, very few places where free expression will perhaps be still able to occur. One of them is on the internet. And we now know that net neutrality, which guarantees sort of equal access and equal, availability of information from all quarters, net neutrality, that thing which was put into effect in 2015 during the second term of Barack Obama, that is now on the chopping block. The Trump administration and the chairman of the FCC and the cable company, greedy cable companies, have banded together to kill net neutrality. In case folks are just need a little primer on what net neutrality is, it is basically the thing that guarantees that all content on the internet is equally accessible at the same speed, and that if net neutrality was dissolved or obliterated, then there would be fast lanes and slow lanes, and this would be determined by the internet service providers, and they could censor or deny content, or they could slow it down based on the payment being made from the people that were trying to get their content up there. So this is an important issue, and there are certain ways that you can push back against it. You could go to freepress.net, freepress.net. I know there's also a freepress.org, I think. But freepress.net has a day of action, which is coming up on July 12th, next week. And organizations and companies will be participating in this day of action. You can sign up and participate at freepress.net. And this will be a way of registering your opinion on this issue. There's also another site that has a very, very useful tool where you can not only send a letter to the FCC, but also be put in touch with all your congressional and representatives with one click of the mouse. And that website is called battleforthenet.com. And so that would be highly recommended for us, because we are, in fact, you know, the internet is the place where for example, a show like this show, which will be archived and turned into a podcast, can be made accessible to people around the globe, you know, at the same rate of accessibility as CBS News or NBC or CNBC or whatever. So, and that is what is under threat here. And so it's very important for free speech that we defend net neutrality. I'm going to turn it back over to you, Ruth Ann, and see if we can get our guest ready to go here.
Okay. Maybe I should talk a little bit about the AAUP. The American Association of University Professors was founded over 100 years ago by, among others, John Dewey, whose name is so important in the whole field of education. It's the professional organization of faculty in all fields of higher education, and it also issues reports and statements that articulate and invigilate principles and policies of the profession, including statements against the encroachment of politics on the search for truth. And I think that makes a visit by someone from the AAUP at this point particularly important, because, again, we have the encroachment of politics on the search for truth. Do you want me to address Professor Reichman? Professor Henry Reichman teaches history at California State University, East Bay. He is first vice president of the AAUP, and most relevant to today's discussion, he is chair of AAUP's Committee A on Academic Freedom and Tenure. His posts on AAUP's Academe blog are thoughtful, well-informed, relevant, and clear. I see Hank every June at the annual AAUP meeting, and you can get to his posts by way of the organization's website, www.aaup.org. But this morning, we have him here on the radio to discuss academic freedom, free speech, and some current events. And I want to say welcome to Hank.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it is great to have you. Perhaps before we get into some pretty deep questions into the stuff that we want to explore today, you can just give us a sense of some of the turmoil that's been happening on campuses, and the fallout that's been coming out into the media on some of the free speech issues and academic freedom issues that you're familiar with.
Well, I think there's been two things that have certainly been in the media a lot recently. One is actually not directly relevant to academic freedom per se, but to the atmosphere on campus for free expression, which clearly implicates academic freedom. And that has been the challenges to outside speakers and controversial ideas that have emerged from quarters on campus, including sometimes from protesting activist students who, however admirable their causes may be, sometimes go a bit too far in their response to ideas they disagree with. On the other hand, then, we in the AAUP think an even more dangerous and frightening trend has been the trend of attacking faculty members and sometimes some students over controversial remarks they may make in social media or on television, on Fox News or places like that. Large numbers of those faculty, a disturbing number of them African American, have been subject to rather vicious campaigns of online and telephone and other harassment, including death threats, threats to their family. One of the most visible and troubling incidents has been actually in Connecticut at Trinity College, where political science professor Johnny Eric Williams made some comments that I think he later regretted on Facebook, although they were nothing that were illegal or promoted violence. And he was subject to a terrible campaign of harassment, which extended not only to him but to the rest of the college, to the point that they believed they had to shut down the school one day. Unfortunately, we believe the college has not taken as strong a stand as they might, and they put Professor Williams on an involuntary leave, which we think is simply the wrong approach to these kinds of incidents.
And the president of Trinity College issued a very strong statement saying that she believes in academic freedom, but she also says that the media pose special challenges. And this, obviously, the leave that she has imposed and the investigation that she says is going forward are triggered more by the concern about social media, I think, than about Professor Williams.
Well, yes, but it's Professor Williams' comments on social media, and social media are social media. People should have the right, including professors, to say what they think on social media. But a campaign of harassment that results in the effective suspension of a faculty member is very troubling, particularly because it sends the message to those people who run the campaign that this is an effective way to silence your opponents. You harass them enough, and then the institution will do the work for you and silence them. And I was very bothered by the statement that the president made, because while she did, in theory, talk about academic freedom, we always hear this, you know, and not just about academic freedom, but about freedom of expression in general, that, you know, well, I believe in free expression, but and then the but is whatever I don't like.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, maybe this is a good time for you to talk about the concept that you used in one of your blogs of the heckler's veto. I had heard that. I thought it was a clever little coinage, but actually it's a serious concept.
Well, it's a concept that has both a legal and a more common usage. Legally, it refers to if people, for instance, there is a speech scheduled somewhere, and the place that has the speech scheduled gets bomb threats, or other sorts of threats, and they decide, well, out of safety, we're going to shut down this speech. That, of course, allows whoever makes the threat to veto the speaker. And the courts have ruled, initially the courts ruled that was a valid reason for shutting down a speech, but in more recent decisions the courts have said, no, it isn't, except in the most extreme cases, and even then there has to be some kind of way to schedule the speech differently. In common usage, it simply means the ability of people to shut down a speaker by heckling. You go to a speech, and heckling is a right that people have. I mean, if a speaker is speaking and says things that people think are outrageous, it's their right to boo, to hiss, to yell things, but not to the extent that they make it impossible for anyone to actually hear the speech. And that's been more the common use of the term heckler's veto.
It's even been extended to a woman laughing in this setting.
Well, yes, in a sense that, of course, in the hearings for Jeff Sessions, he made an answer and a woman in the audience laughed, and she was charged with a minor but still a crime. I guess you could say that as an example of heckler's veto, although the law there would be that, you know, the Senate has the right to set its rules of decorum.
Yeah, I suppose so. But when we talk about that concept, the heckler's veto, we're also talking about something that you discussed in one of your blogs, the right to learn. The right to listen, the freedom of listening. And I kind of think that ought to be added to the First Amendment, because the freedom of speech may give us the liberty to mouth off appropriately or sometimes inappropriately, but we do forget that there is also a freedom of listening.
Well, you know, when you said added to the First Amendment, I don't think we need to add anything, because the First Amendment is a rather simple language. Congress shall make no law, you know, barring freedom of speech, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
When we talk First Amendment, we really mean the centuries of judicial interpretation of that amendment that have evolved over time. And those interpretations indeed do include a freedom to listen, a freedom to hear ideas, which is good. I think you're absolutely right that if people can't hear the ideas being spoken and respond to them, including negatively, then the freedom to speech is pretty hollow.
Absolutely. I suppose that this is a good time to explain the relationship and distinctions between freedom of speech and academic freedom. We use the term, critics on the right of education use it in a kind of a sneering way, but it's a very distinctive term to people who are associated with education.
Well, let me say, first of all, I'd say only some critics on the right. There are many conservative professors who value academic freedom precisely because in many places, and particularly in some disciplines, conservative ideas are in the minority and need to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
But the term academic freedom actually developed first in Germany in the 19th century with two elements, the freedom to teach and the freedom to learn. They were mostly concentrated there around the autonomy of the university from the state, which controlled all education in Germany in the 19th century. In the United States in 1915, in its first year of existence, the AAUP codified academic freedom as having essentially three basic elements. First, the freedom to teach in the classroom according to the professor's understanding of the discipline and the subject matter. The second, freedom to conduct research according to the professor's own research program and to publish the results freely. And third, and this has been the most controversial part, is what we in the AUP have come to call extramural expression, which literally means expression outside the walls of the institution, which refers to the right of professors to speak as citizens about any concept or any idea in the public realm that they wish without threat of institutional consequences and discipline from their university or college. Now, it's important to recognize that these three freedoms are not quite the same as the First Amendment. Under the First Amendment, one has the right to say anything one wishes, including some very, very stupid things. But in the classroom, the professor does not have the freedom to say whatever he or she wishes. They must actually teach the subject matter, and their right stems to teach it as they please, not from the right of the so-called free marketplace of ideas, but from their professional discipline and training and standing in their field, so that the right of a scientist to teach is because that person is trained in science. Similarly with research, extramural expression, which is the most controversial, is a little more complicated. To be sure, the average citizen in a non-government job does not have a First Amendment right to speak publicly on issues and can, unfortunately, be fired sometimes from a job because of their views on something. I think that right should be extended to everybody. But for faculty members, it's important because even in areas outside the professor's own expertise, if the professor fears being silenced in one area, he or she is going to fear being silenced in their own area. The other thing about the extramural expression is it is closely linked with the broader atmosphere of freedom of expression on the campus. If we believe, as I do, that even the most controversial and perhaps foolish speakers could come to campus, say, for instance, a Milo Yiannopoulos or mm-hmm. Ann Coulter, and speak their mind, what are we to say then when a professor, in a certain sense, under academic freedom, has less rights? A professor can't say stuff like that in the classroom. If we're going to guarantee the rights of everybody to come to campus, then we must guarantee the rights of the faculty off campus to speak their minds and sometimes say some things that are foolish, mistaken, or that they might regret. And that, of course, applies as well to social media, which is, of course, a whole new development because it allows so many people to respond to speech so quickly. In ways that even an op-ed piece in a newspaper or a public talk somewhere might not.
Yes, and it's very seductive because reading other people's posts is so energizing sometimes, and there your little fingers go straight to the keyboard, whether it be Facebook or Twitter, and the impulse to spew is very strong. We generally practice a little bit of self-censorship. What we fear is
there's a thin line sometimes between self-censorship, in which basically your opponents have won by silencing you before you ever speak, and being just, you know, careful.
Self-restraint.
Self-restraint, right? That's a wonderful distinction because I once wrote a blog post called "Can I Tweet That?" And what I meant was, do I have the right to tweet that? But I also could have written in a companion post, should I tweet that?
Right, absolutely. Very good. You conclude the last part of your series on academic freedom and college speakers with the very important question, what is to be done? Because as you said at the beginning of this conversation, people can lose their voices as other people's voices predominate in a public forum, a public discussion. And there are people who need to be heard and have important things to say. So I saw in the list that you offered from a colleague that there are a lot of ways of making the opportunities for these voices to be heard in more constructive fora.
Well, yes, and I think there are three things that I would emphasize here. One is that the old principle articulated, I believe, by Oliver Wendell Holmes on the Supreme Court, that the answer to bad speech is more speech. And I think we all have an obligation to speak out and correct ideas where you think are wrong, not simply tell people that they can't speak. The second, I think, is even more important, however, is that I think institutions and their faculty need to develop, develop a spine that as long as people are going to intimidate you, whether it's people trying to bar outside speakers or, as I said, the even more dangerous thing of harassing faculty, institutions need to stand up and say, no, this is not what we are about, because otherwise it just encourages even more of this kind of behavior. And then the third thing I would say is that I think we all need, the public in general needs to speak out and be able to get a better understanding of the importance of both freedom of expression in general and academic freedom in particular, and rise to their defense against forces that are either directly attacking them or going around them and using them for purposes that ultimately chill both scholarship and free discussion.
We're speaking with Henry Reichman, who is of the American Association of University Professors. He's the first vice president, chair of Committee A on Academic Freedom and Tenure. Can you, Henry? Could you comment on the effect of sort of the new political climate? Beginning on January 20th with the inauguration of the 45th president, how this new political climate is impacting these issues that we're talking about today. What has changed? How has the pressure been ratcheted up, if it has at all?
Well, first of all, I'd say it's probably November 9th rather than January 20th. Yeah. But nothing has changed in the sense that none of the challenges we are facing in academia, to academic freedom or to free expression in general, is new. They've been there certainly since the birth of the AAUP over 100 years ago. What is different has been the intensity. We saw in the immediate aftermath of the election and then continuing a significant increase in hate crimes on campuses and the harassment of faculty members online, et cetera, for controversial remarks or controversial actions, we have incidents of that before the election of Donald Trump, but the number and intensity of them have grown. And at the same time, from the other side, I think the intensity of opposition to conservative ideas among other people on campus has also grown as the fear has developed among certain sources, certain groups on campus, particularly minorities, immigrant students, LGBTQ students, women. Who fear that their place in the university is now endangered by this new atmosphere and mood, and they sometimes may go too far in the other direction, although I think that's much less of a challenge. But in general, I guess it's the increased polarization of American politics that has had an impact on the campuses.
Indeed. One last point I wanted to ask you about is the effect of let's say legislative or executive order action that could have impacts on activities on campuses, and I want to refer specifically to legislation proposed by a senator from Washington State, whose name, oddly enough, is Senator Michael Baumgartner.
No relation
to Ruth Ann. Who announced that he will be proposing a bill to block universities from engaging in protests targeted at the State of Israel. And the bill is directed at the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, also called BDS, which is present on campuses, and which it will seek to increase economic and political pressures on the State of Israel to and its presence in Palestinian territories. That's what the BDS movement is trying to do. Right. But this bill would would ban those activities on campus. Are you familiar with this, and are you aware of...
Well, I'm not familiar with that specific bill, although it hardly surprises me. We've seen legislation proposed like that before. The way you described it, it's blatantly unconstitutional. But I think what we've also seen has been is broader efforts to limit protest under the name of protecting free speech, because, in fact, the heckler's veto does exist. There has been legislation proposed, passed in some states, that would call on campuses to impose strict certain kinds of discipline. Sometimes the bills actually mandate certain levels of discipline for anyone who disrupts a speech. And, of course, what does disruption mean? Is it really preventing the speech, or is it just simply demonstrating outside or inside the hall a little too vociferously? Unclear. Some of these pieces of legislation propose sort of Orwellian committees on free expression that would actually judge when free expression happens or not. In other words, who's going to decide which expression should be free, which isn't? One such bill, by the way, was passed in Louisiana. Unfortunately, the Democratic governor vetoed it by saying that it was a solution in search of a problem. That we have a First Amendment, and we have all the laws around it, and we do not need this extra legislation. A similar bill is under consideration currently in Wisconsin, where one of the senators was asked, "Well, would this bill protect a student's right to answer a question about evolution on the exam by saying the world was created in 6,000 days?" Or whatever it is that's supposedly the strict biblical interpretation of creation. And the sponsoring senator said, "Well, I'm not sure whether it applied, but that's a science, that's a fact that it was."
Oh.
So you can see behind a lot of this legislation, and it would be just as true as the anti-BDS legislation, or for that matter, the AUP also opposes academic boycotts of Israel and other countries as an inappropriate way of advancing the agenda of their supporters. We generally oppose legislative interference. We think the laws are clear enough. It's really up to institutions to enact and then to enforce appropriate policies on campus.
And so much of the effort to shut people up in various ways can be responded to in the classroom, as you said in that same blog, the ways that the classroom can both model constructive debate and respect for multiple points of view, and also provide a voice for students who have urgent things that they feel they have to express, as long as we stay more or less on topic in the classroom.
Right, absolutely. I think in almost every discipline on campus, including even very practical so-called disciplines, the purpose of the learning is not to just memorize rote information, but to learn how to think. In professional or practical courses, think about the particular field in ways that are would allow you to function better in life, and that means being able to entertain conflicting and different and sometimes unpleasant ideas, and to engage with them critically using your intelligence rather than strictly your emotions. That's what education should be about, and I think the classroom is a place where we can engage ideas in a way that models the best ways to engage ideas rather than the worst ways, which sometimes sound like, an argument between two drunks in a bar.
And is it tempting to you to plug any films that may be coming up in the next couple of years on ways in which some of us learned by experience? Good ways to protest.
I think I know the softball you're hitting. You're pitching to me right now, because we showed excerpts from a forthcoming film at our annual conference called A Time to Stir, which is a documentary film that's been 10 years in the making about the 1968 Columbia University student rebellion. That was where I was a student, and I was involved in that student rebellion. The film is, I think, it's going to be a six-hour documentary. At one point, it was a 30-hour documentary. I think the only person who supported that length.
Well, I would go for that, too.
But, I'm a historian, so I'm a completist. But that film, I believe, will be coming out in time for the 50th anniversary. There's also a wonderful film about the Cornell and San Francisco State student strikes of 1969 and 1970, which for some reason, oh my God, the name just slipped out of my head right now. We've actually, the AUP Foundation gave some money to support the film. We've shown it 2 years in a row at our summer institute, and the name will come to me probably as soon as we hang up.
Well, we have really enjoyed this conversation with Professor Henry Reichman, who was Professor Emeritus of History at the California State University, East Bay, and he is Chair of the Committee A on Academic Freedom and Tenure for the American Association of University Professors. It's been very enlightening and most engaging to have you with us today. We thank you for getting up very early in California to speak with us today here.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
It's been great to talk to you, Hank.
And let's do it again sometime. Thank you.
Sure. Anytime.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. And this is, let me just get myself together here. Okay. So we are proceeding with the Resistance Roundtable here on WPKN. My name is Richard Hill. My co-host, Ruth M. Baumgartner, is also on mic. And we welcome your comments and participation here by calling 203-336-9756 as we sort of point the finger in any direction and come up with an issue of concern to people that are fighting for a fair and just society in the face of a very, very virulent and egregious right-wing united front, or maybe not quite so united, but it is coming at us from all directions. So as we, looks like we do have a phone call. Let me just get that up. Phone call came and went, but if you're trying to call, it is 203-336-9756. We ask you to observe a decorum on the phone calls. We do not have a time delay. That is to say, we adhere to the FCC language requirements. Some words you say and some words you don't say. But in any case, please join in the conversation on the Resistance Roundtable. One of the things that we could mention is that the there has been something we've mentioned before, but we're going to give some specifics on this today. Here's that phone call again. Let me see if I can grab it. Hello, are you with us on the phone?
Oh, hi. Yes, I was listening to your program on WPKN and the Astra calls, and I had a thought that I'd like to communicate if they're interested.
We are on the air with you. So first,
thank you.
Can you just say your first name, please?
Joan.
All right, Joan, go for it. Yeah, go ahead with your thought.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to thank the gentleman for his program and his distinguished guests. I encounter it every once in a while when I'm floating by on Saturday, and it's always an interesting program. And I just wanted to say something. I was kind of shocked. They were speaking about free speech. I was kind of shocked when I spoke to my son who lives in New York the other day, and we were talking about the political situation that was distressing to us, and he said something that prompted me to think of something that I had never really considered, which was the tremendous cowardice that is being demonstrated by our political leaders, the people who are supposed to speak to us, for us in Congress. Because my son said, you know, the Trump agenda is so appalling and so shocking, and the things that he does, like spend millions going on vacation, the most simple things, you know, at the taxpayer's expense, not to mention other things like throwing large bombs around the world for an unexplained reason. But he said, nobody is saying anything. And I said, what do you mean about nobody? I was thinking, is he talking about his colleagues at work? Who is he talking about? He said, no, you listen to the congressional hearings, it's all just blabbity-blub. The only person that spoke out was, I think her name is Catherine Harris, but Mrs. Harris from California spoke out. Yeah, she was the only one in the last hearing.
Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about the fact of cowardice. This nation's myth is we are the home of the brave. There's nothing brave about these congressmen. They're not only corrupt, they're also pusillanimous, which, you know, I hadn't really thought of before in those terms. I just thought they were just like everybody else, scared of losing their jobs. No, they're not scared of losing their jobs. They're cowards, moral, and they're cowards because their job is to represent us, to speak out. And they're not doing that. And most of them, I'm not speaking of everyone, because, of course, I think our representatives are great in Connecticut. And I've written to them. I write them letters and tell them I think they're great and thank you. But that was the only thing I wanted to bring up, the point of cowardice, because we don't get shot yet in this country. It's a question of time. But we don't get shot yet because we open our mouths. And so I think that that needs to be considered, the terrible fear. Fear is a great leverage on political speech. And these people in Congress are not only afraid of not getting their next contribution, they're afraid, period, of Trump. And being afraid of Trump is a very dangerous situation nationally. I'm so sorry to intrude with my own personal opinion. Thank you.
It was well stated, and we appreciate it very much, Joan. Thanks for calling.
I think that a lot of self-censorship comes from fear. And when you look at what happened in when I was in Washington for the AAUP meeting, and the man came and opened fire on Republican senators who were practicing for the next day's congressional charity baseball game. And I believe that the one senator has been put back in intensive care again. Mm-hmm. This is terrible. People get churned up and they walk around carefully armed by the NRA and by legislators who have enabled the NRA to increase their market. And speaking your mind sometimes can, I mean, we've become convinced that speaking your mind puts you perhaps at physical risk as well as political risk and job risk and every other kind of risk. But I, too, have noticed, I think, the silence, particularly from the Republican Party in Congress.
All right. Let's see. We might have another call here. Hello. You're on the air.
Hi. It's Kara.
Oh, Kara. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for calling. Yes, we've spoken before, so why don't you tell our listening audience your connection to the fight back that's happening in our community.
So my name is Kara Rochelle. I work with several organizations around the state to fight back against what's happening in Washington and what's happening with the slow creep of Republicans taking over Connecticut as well. So I work with Connecticut Young Democrats. I work with Action Together Connecticut. I work with them. They're friends with those folks and just keep in touch with and organize with and coordinate with several other organizations across the state. So it's been pretty cool. It's gotten a pretty global understanding of how all these different organizations are working and working together. You know, you guys were talking a lot about fear and folks not fighting back as directly as they should. But what I've seen is that, at least in Connecticut, the activist groups and the young people are really not letting that slow them down at all.
So, how would you assess at this point? I mean, because we've seen an incredible process of the coalescence of many different prongs of resistance in the state of Connecticut, and now it's summertime, you know, and people are kind of sort of like a little bit of deflation is going on as people head for the beaches, and there's a sense of sort of, oh my God, we need a break from all this. How would you assess where we stand right now in terms of building and continuing resistance and moving toward actually local elections, which are coming up in Connecticut at the municipal level right here in this fall of 2017? Is it robust? Is it losing energy? How do you see it?
So, in general, I'd say it's pretty robust in Connecticut. We're very lucky in that way. While, you know, there's not necessarily as much of a visible boisterous noise making happening, in the sense that there's not, you know, as many marches in the streets going on, things of that nature. There's certainly a lot of meetings and organizing happening all over the state. You know, you look at groups like Indivisible, where they have, you know, 50 people showing up at their meetings, and, you know, groups like Hamden Progressive Action Network, all the PAN groups that have regular meetings going on. Action Together did a really great round of budget forums in every district in the state, where they got the lawmakers in the room, all the Democratic lawmakers, and pressed them on progressive issues. What we're looking at for fall is we're literally right now in the process of putting together a training session, which is going to happen in New Haven on the 20th. To convert people from, you know, talking about what's going on and, you know, learning about what's going on, to knowing how to actually affect elections, and training them in the best way to do that, and pointing them towards the races that will have the biggest impact. Because it's one thing, you know, a problem that we're finding is that a lot of the most active folks in the scene tend to live and socialize in robust blue areas. And the help really needs to be in these kind of areas that have gone purple or have flipped red. And there's a lot of work being done between multiple organizations that are working together to make sure that folks know how, where, and what. So I would definitely point people towards that event on the 20th in New Haven at Mactivity. And I would definitely point them towards organizations like Action Together, even Connecticut Young Democrats, that have like four new chapters that are either sprouted up or in the process of being built. And, you know, really where we are with it is we've gotten a lot of new people onto town committees. For folks that don't know the structure of how it works in Connecticut, the first line of defense, if we're looking at, you know, making sure that our lawmakers are doing what we need them to do to defend us against what's happening in D.C. and to help us get where we need to be with Connecticut, is to get on these decision-making committees across the state, which are the Democratic Town Committees. And there's a really great group called Dementor, which has been basically creating a buddy system where they say to people, if you're interested in getting involved, we can pair you with somebody who's on a committee and get you in the door. And kind of training people to get in. And I think they've gotten about 150 people or so to start going to their town committee meetings or get onto town committees. We have a working list with Young Dems of people that are running for office from across the state. You know, several of the groups, different grassroots groups have gotten together to discuss which races they want to target, as I mentioned. And another really cool thing that's happening that's on the horizon is with the gubernatorial race next year, because everyone's starting so early, all of these groups recognize that we have a specific opportunity in the middle of this crisis to really show the importance and the force of all of these activist groups, and how much we see this as something that, you know, we all rise together, we work hand in hand. So they're putting together it's being spearheaded by the Working Families in conjunction with, you know, Black Lives Matter and several other groups, to have a gubernatorial debate where we invite everyone who's running both sides of the aisle and say, we want you guys to answer the questions that matter to us. Mm-hmm. And if they're wise, they'll recognize that, you know, these are the folks that show up to knock doors. These are the folks that show up to vote. These are the folks that will put the time and effort in. And these are the folks that you need to win over if you want to actually win the race. Mm. So we're applying a lot of pressure in a lot of different ways. It's not so much that people are fizzled as they're focusing in, which seems quieter, but it's just more one-on-one. You know, we're going to be having those personal conversations at doors really soon. You know, even folks like Chris Murphy, he recognized it. He put together a Fight Back CT. And the focus of that effort is going to be to get people canvassing and talking to voters about what matters to them, so that we can then make sure that when we're looking at races, we're looking at, you know, making sure that we're connecting with voters about the issues when we're running candidates.
Well, Kara, we want to thank you very much. Kara with Connecticut. There are two progressive Connecticut progressive groups. So yours is Connecticut Progressives. Is that what it is?
So I also work with CT Progressives. We were kind of evolution out of, we were a bunch of people that worked in the Sanders campaign and then said, you know, that's going to be done and we don't want progressive efforts to end. So it's funny because that started beginning of 2016. And right now it mostly functions as a Facebook group and a way for folks to get information out. And a lot of the people that started that group have gone on to various other, you know, organizations that they more directly put boots on the ground with. But we all keep in touch and put information out through those channels.
Right.
And it's funny because, you know, the progressive network in this state is really breathtaking. I've been doing activist organizing for several years now, and I've seen nothing like it. The amount of talent and dedication that's gone into it in this state. So I'm pretty optimistic about this coming year. There's some great candidates coming up this fall.
Great. We're going to have to cut it here as we're fresh out of time. Thank you, Kara Rochelle, for calling. And and we'll talk again soon, we hope. We want to let you know that you've been listening to the Resistance Roundtable, WPKN's monthly show that comes to you the second Saturday of each month. It will be a podcast in short order. You will find it there with others of its ilk. And my name is Richard Hill with Ruth Ann Baumgartner. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned for more great programming here at WPKN.
It's an emotional experience when I have to retire my old car. After all the places we've been together, it's sad to send it to the boneyard or sell it to a stranger. That's why I donated my last car to WPKN via the link at WPKN.org. It was easy, and the money the station got was more than I could have comfortably given as a cash donation. I got a generous tax deduction, which lowered what I owed to the IRS. Those things made me feel good, turning what could have been a sad parting with my old Mazda into a cause for celebration. If it's time to let go of your old car, or even your boat, plane, or RV, you can feel good about it too. Click on the car key icon at WPKN.org and follow the simple instructions, or call 877-WPKN-CAR. It's easy, efficient, and you'll quickly receive the form you need for your tax deduction.
Did you know that you can take WPKN with you wherever you go? WPKN now has both Apple and Android apps.